Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's June 28th, 2019 program, Combating Commercial Sexual Exploitation. This is the 38th program for our 2018-2019 programming year. I am President-elect Jesse Guilleri filling in for Eric Richardson today, who was unable to be here. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, thanks to our sponsors. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and communities we serve. For more information, www.kp.org. University of Oregon. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, U of O has helped Oregonians question critically, thinking logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. For more information, at uofo.edu. Peace Health. At Peace Health, our mission is our shared purpose since we founded more than 125 years ago, to promote personal and community wellness, to relieve pain and suffering, to treat each person in a loving and caring way. For more information, visit peacehealth.org and our Sapphire sponsor. Support for City Club comes from Summit Bank, your local community bank. An independent community bank headquartered in Eugene, Summit Bank serves businesses and professionals in Eugene, Springfield, and Central Oregon communities. For more information, visit sbko.bank. Today's program, Combating Commercial Sexual Exploitation. Sex trafficking is a form of slavery in which victims are induced to engage in sex through force or fraud. Sex traffickers frequently target vulnerable victims and then use violence, threats, lies, false promises, debt bondage, or other forms of control and manipulation to keep victims involved in the sex industry. Sex trafficking occurs in many different environments, including the trap stocks, strip clubs, hostess clubs, hotels, and motels along the I-5 corridor. Today's guests, who will be speaking on the issue, Tamara Leroy, will describe the activities of Lane County Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children Multidisciplinary Team, a collaborative effort between community partners and agencies to support and facilitate survivor center approaches to combat sex trafficking. Detective Curvis A. Newell of the Eugene Police Department will describe how law enforcement approaches commercial sex exploitation, including local criminals, trends, and recent cases. Please give a round of applause to our speakers.
My name is Tamara, and I am a confidential advocate at Sexual Assault Support Services of Lane County, and I have advocate privilege, and we'll talk about that a little bit later and the importance of that role in this. I'm also the Trafficking Intervention Coordinator for Lane County CSEC MDT, which is a little bit of alphabet soup, so I'll just break that down for you really quickly. Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children Multidisciplinary Team. So before I get into all of that, I'm going to talk a little bit about what the prevalence is in our community. So a lot of times people really want to have a lot of statistics about what we see in our community, but because this issue is so complex and so prevalent, we don't have complete data. There is a lot of reasons why people may not report this, or maybe why they might report it in a way that doesn't come up as trafficking. And so we do know that it happens, and it happens in a variety of ways in our community. During the introduction, we heard a little bit about it happening at truck stops, it happens in motels, but it also happens in our homes, here in our community. Children are a vulnerable population that are exploited in this way. So these kids in our community, they go to our schools. So we see this happening throughout our community. The definition of human trafficking is defined at the federal level through force, fraud, or coercion, right? And for human trafficking, that can include labor trafficking. It can include sex trafficking. A lot of times, there's quite a bit of crossover there. The important part is to know that it includes force, fraud, or coercion for those that are 18 and over. For those that are under 18, those elements don't need to be present for it to count as trafficking. One of the common misconceptions is that it includes movement from one place to the other in order to be classified as trafficking, but trafficking happens at the local level where there's no movement that happens. And for youth explicitly, it's really important to recognize that they don't need to be tricked or coerced. That part of the law really kind of gets at that vulnerability of being under 18, not having the same power to be in the world as an adult. So in our case, the commercial sexual exploitation of children, CSEC is how we refer to it, really speaks to that power imbalance for children. And then the MDT that Kurt is a part of and that I coordinate in part was formed out of a recognition that this population is somebody that everybody sees, right? If you're working with a human population, you're working with a trafficked population at some point. People in convenience stores, people in schools, people in hotels, people on the street come in contact with a trafficked population. The people that we see typically that have higher risk factors are from vulnerable populations. So what we think of, you know, maybe at the beginning is people of color, right? We're in a white dominant culture here in Eugene, so people of culture have extra vulnerabilities. But people who identify with any sort of, say, sexual orientation outside of what we would consider to be typical or the majority, such as members of the LGBTQIAA+ community, or people who maybe have a different gender identification outside of heteronormative, so somebody who is maybe transgender would be within that. Our indigenous populations are also a population that is at higher risk. Children who have experienced violence in their youth, so exposure to domestic violence in their homes, have an increased risk. There are so many vulnerable populations in our community, and they are extra vulnerable to this particular type of exploitation. And before we started this presentation today, I was asked if there was one takeaway that I wanted to have for our community from this presentation, it would be to recognize those vulnerable populations and provide them with support as you can. So sometimes that can be the difference between turning away or offering a kind word, but knowing that when people have vulnerabilities, it makes them vulnerable to this type of exploitation. In our community in Lane County, like many counties in Oregon, we have a fractured support system, right? We don't have sufficient funding to offer the services to folks who have vulnerabilities, which can also include mental health issues, it can include drug dependency issues, all sorts of things. And so because we have this fractured system that is insufficient to meet the needs of these survivors, we, with the help of our Child Advocacy Center, which is here in Lane County, is Kids First, and SAS, formed the multidisciplinary team. And within that team, we try to get everybody to the table who is in like a service providing position to talk about what they're seeing so that we can, first of all, better identify what's happening in our community and what it looks like, because it's really complex. It's not like, you know, here's the little square, and if you fit into this box, this is what it looks like, and this is what we know, and here's how we can serve these folks. That's not what it looks like. Sometimes it looks like domestic violence. A youth who's being trafficked might refer to her trafficker as her boyfriend. You know, now how are we better able to know what that looks like? Sometimes a youth might access health services. One of the statistics that we do have is that roughly 80% of folks who have been trafficked report receiving regular medical care, but only 6% of healthcare professionals and practitioners report having come in contact with this population. That is a huge disparity. So by creating this multidisciplinary team, we have medical providers at the table, we have law enforcement like Kurt, we have Looking Glass Youth Services is one of our community partners. We try to make up for this fractured system that we have and provide services better by coming together and partnering with other agencies. So that's the purpose of the CSEC MDT. We have several committees that meet: victim services, we have an education and outreach committee, we have our law enforcement criminal justice committee, we have representatives from all levels of law enforcement, from local municipal all the way up to the FBI. We have representatives all throughout the legal system, again, from our local level all the way through the U.S. Attorney's Office. Our community organizations and partners include the Department of Human Services, other non-GOs like ours. Sexual Assault Support Services is a nonprofit. So mostly professionals that are working in this field. So my role as a coordinator is one to serve as a single point of contact for our community. This topic, as many of you know, is something that wasn't even on people's radar even 5 or 10 years ago. But right now it's getting a lot of public attention. We hear about it in the news at the national level. We see statistics. We see advertisements. Oregon recently passed some, I believe, legislation that all of the rest stops have posters on what to do if you need to be free, right? And one of the most common questions that we get is, what can we do? So as we're in this sort of emerging public awareness phase, the one thing that we recommend for people, if they suspect that somebody is being trafficked, is to contact the National Human Trafficking Line. And I'll give you that number if you guys want to write this down. It's 888-373-7888. That's a National Human Trafficking Hotline. And you can make a report there. And they have a whole system where you call into that centralized number, and then any information that you give is filtered down through the state and even to the local level. If somebody discloses to you that they are being trafficked, first of all, it's unlikely that they'll come to you and say, "Help, I'm being trafficked," because again, a lot of people don't know that that is what is happening to them. They identify maybe as abuse, as sexual abuse, as, like I said, domestic violence or intimate partner violence. But if somebody does disclose to you, we know from the research that having a positive disclosure experience is one of the number one ways that we can help ease the fallout from trauma, right? Being trafficked is a traumatic experience. And when people experience trauma, there's all sorts of things. It affects every aspect of your life. When it comes to a violent situation, having a positive disclosure is the number one way that we can help ameliorate that. So I have a few tips for you. If somebody discloses that they're being trafficked, or if they've been a survivor of any kind of violence, sexual violence, domestic violence, intimate partner violence, so you can write these things down too if you'd like. You want to listen and you want to believe. The one thing, the main reason why most survivors don't disclose that they've been the victim of some form of violence is because they fear not being believed. They fear other things happening. So you can listen to them and you can believe. In my field, what we say is acknowledge, validate, and then refer. So I hear what you're saying. That sounds really hard. I'm sorry that happened to you. I believe you is one of the most powerful things that you can say to somebody when they're disclosing to you. And then you can refer them to an appropriate agency or organization. Some folks may want to go to law enforcement right away. You can refer them to law enforcement. Some people may disclose to you in your line of work. You can refer them to somebody at your agency who you feel might be able to better refer them. You can always refer them to our agency, Sexual Assault Support Services. And earlier, I talked about how we at SAS are advocates who have advocate privilege. And what that means is that we are not mandatory reporters, which might seem a little off-putting to many of you, right? We think that when somebody reports a crime, the immediate and appropriate course of action is to report to law enforcement so that they can be protected. But sometimes when people are involved in ongoing violence, making that disclosure may further endanger them. And so from my agency's standpoint, we believe that survivors are their own best expert and they have their own knowledge about what is to keep them safe during their disclosure and after. And so we're able to provide them with options, and we can provide them with information. If you engage this agency, here's what might happen. If you do this, here's what might happen. Let's talk about safety planning. So that's how we handle things. And we have access, not only through the MDT, but also through our community partnerships as a sexual assault agency, to other agencies and other people who are survivor-centered and who can help survivors identify their own best way to move through their own trauma. So I'll just give you our contact information. The SAS business line is 541-484-9791. And then we also have a crisis and support line that's available 24 hours a day, and that's 541-343-7277. And that's about all I have for you today. I'm going to turn the time over to Kurt Newell, and he's going to talk about the trafficking issue from the law enforcement perspective.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me talk to you guys today. Again, my name's Kurt Newell. I'm a detective right now with the Eugene Police Department. I'm assigned to our Special Investigations Unit, where one of our main assignments is working sex trafficking cases. I've been a police officer for more than 16 years and working sex trafficking cases for the last 10 of those years. So I've got a little bit of experience in the field, so I just appreciate you giving me the time to come out and hopefully give you guys some information that you can take home with you and use, and just generally provide a little bit more awareness than you may not have already had. Just a show of hands, how many people have sat through any kind of human trafficking presentation before? Okay. So for the most part, it seems like for us, as Tamara mentioned, sex trafficking can be presented in a number of ways. I'm here to talk to you about the law enforcement approach to commercial sexual exploitation or sex trafficking. There's a number of different ways that it's being referred to, as well as some of the criminal trends and maybe some local cases if we have a little bit of time. But primarily what that means for us on the law enforcement side, as Tamara mentioned, is basically prostitution, where people are being forced to do it, or there's a fraud component involved, or a coercion component, or if the victim or survivor is a minor. And so those are the kind of the cases as they come to us. As Tamara mentioned, at the federal level, the definition reads very similarly as the state level. And so federally, we would take a case, would read almost identical to the state statutes. That doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot to you guys, but we just have two different avenues to prosecute those people who are responsible for trafficking of the victim survivors. Generally, just so you know, it's easier to have somewhat of a basis of knowledge. This class could be 2 or 3 hours or more to try to fit all the information in, but I think it's good to have kind of a basic working knowledge of the dynamic of sex trafficking, kind of how that relationship works, because it's basically, it's just like any business model, there's a hierarchy involved. So on the top of the business model of sex trafficking, you have the trafficker, commonly referred to as a pimp. And from the law enforcement perspective, that's our main focus, other than trying to recover the victims and direct them towards services. In Tamara's world, our goal is to try to put these people in prison for as long as we can. And so you have that trafficker at the top of the pyramid, and then you also have recruiters who are actively going out into our community, into our high schools, into our Eugene Public Library, the Lane Transit District Station. You'll see a lot of homeless youth kind of congregating in some of those areas. And the recruiters in the prostitution world know that as well, and so these are kind of hot spots for them to go out and recruit youth or other, you know, disadvantaged citizens into this seedy world where they find themselves, you know, ultimately without a way to get out. And so the recruiters are also folks that law enforcement are aware of, and we like to go out and try to hold them accountable as well. And of course, you have the sex workers. Just to make it easier for understanding, depending who you talk to or what media outlet you might read a story on the topic, you might hear them referred to as a bunch of different things. But when we're talking about the sex workers, they're the victims in the judicial world. They're often referred to as victims in a court setting. Obviously, they're survivors of the situation that they find themselves in as well, so they're referred to as survivors. But they're part of that. And then the part of the business model for the prostitution enterprise sometimes people forget about is the demand side. So we focus on the Johns as well. Not only the Johns, who are the sex customers, targeting the sex providers, but also we like to target the sex buyers that are focused on children as well. And so I can talk to you a little bit about what we're doing with that from the law enforcement perspective. So you're aware, I mean, the sex trafficking world is one of the fastest growing criminal enterprises still today. If you want to put it into perspective, an analogy that I use, just because I've worked drug narcotic cases as well, is and if you picture a drug dealer who's got a pound of, let's say, cocaine, and they want to sell it, they sell it for whatever the price is, and then it's gone to the end user. In the sex trafficking world, the pimps or the traffickers will have the sex workers that are out there on the streets that they can sell over and over and over and over again, and they do that many times a day, every single day. So for them, it's a renewable resource, and unfortunately, the traffickers are very well aware of that, and so many folks in that criminal world have migrated over to the sex trafficking world, which is kind of why that's trending in an upward manner. So for us, as far as the law enforcement side goes, we take a victim-based approach or a survivor-based approach. And basically what that means is we recognize that a lot of these sex workers that are out there are not doing it by choice. In fact, almost every single one I've talked to told me that, you know, they don't wake up one day and say, hey, I want to go have sex with strangers every single day of my life, and then, oh, by the way, give the money that I paid to somebody else who's regularly beating me or demeaning me or, you know, any number of things, threatening me. It's just not the reality from why people end up finding themselves in that situation. Oftentimes, from talking to survivors, they end up being recruited, as I mentioned earlier, but ultimately tricked into the life in one fashion or another. There's a common theme is kind of that wine me, dine me phase, I guess, to put it in easier terms. But they'll be made to believe that the trafficker is in love with them and that they have a romantic relationship that they can pursue. And then at some point, the trafficker kind of manipulates that relationship into a prostitution a type of relationship. And so once they can get that sex worker to commit that first act of prostitution, then they will use that as leverage over them as well. Tamara mentioned some of the tools in their toolbox is force, fraud, or coercion, which is also within the legal world that we work within. But they're doing that in a way where they will threaten these victims' families. If they don't go out and, you know, engage in sex work on a regular basis, then they'll harm, you know, mothers, grandmothers, children. They will threaten them with violence, of course, to themselves. They will threaten them with law enforcement, believe it or not. They will tell them that what they're doing is illegal and that if they try to report it to the police, then they'll go to jail. And I'm here to tell you, is prostitution illegal? Yes, it's not legal to go out and be paid for sex. But law enforcement, as I mentioned, realizes how this dynamic works, which is why we take a victim-based approach, meaning we would rather encounter a sex worker and try to provide them with resources to help get them out of the life that they find themselves in. We would like to build a rapport with those people so we can have them help us in a judicial process. If we're going to try to make a criminal case on a sex trafficker, we would need somebody who's been victimized in that world to stand up and come forward and be confident or stable or strong enough to want to talk about those aspects of their life that aren't glamorous and easy to talk about. But unfortunately, the way our judicial system works is we would need those folks to come forward. And so rapport building is a big thing that we try to accomplish as well with the survivors and victims, which is another reason why we started the CSEC multidisciplinary team, is because we've got all of those local folks in one room and we can coordinate some of those responses for services and rehabilitation and everything. And then, of course, our main focus being on putting the traffickers and recruiters in prison. A little bit of history, I guess. Back in the day, I mean, prostitution is one of the oldest lifestyles around. It's been around forever. We used to see it come by the way of the streetwalkers, people advertising, walking down the streets. It still exists to a certain extent. We don't see it as much. So the internet and social media are huge when it comes for advertising these types of services. And so we, as law enforcement, will focus our investigations on the internet, trying to keep up with technology, because that's where everybody in the prostitution enterprise works within. And so that's been a little bit of a challenge over the years. When I first started, it was Craigslist, the classified advertising website that you can go online and you can rent a car, buy a lawnmower, or unfortunately you could buy people for sex. They had a specific section that was designated for adult services or whatever they referred to it back then. But ultimately, you could go online and find somebody, contact them, and pay them for sex. That's how it worked. The government shut that website, that part of the website down. Craigslist still exists, but not that section. And so everything migrated to Backpage.com, which is another online classified advertising website. Backpage did exactly the same thing Craigslist did, and they had an adult services section where you could find all of those ads listed. Well, Backpage a couple years ago got shut down, and so now we're keeping up and trying to keep up with the fallout, but essentially there's not just one specific place that you can find these advertisements, which has been a challenge for law enforcement. We're aware of several of them, but I guarantee you there's several of them that we're missing out on. But we do, when we start an investigation, kind of seek those out, and that's how we kind of begin most of our investigations. Tamara kind of mentioned it's hit or miss whether or not a survivor will report to law enforcement initially. We do get people that report being victims of sex trafficking to us. We get tips from the other agencies that those same victims may disclosed to on the front end, and in a perfect world, when the tips get forwarded to us, we're able to successfully work a case on those. So it comes to us in a number of ways. So when we do, just if you're not aware, oftentimes myself or my partners will pose as undercover customers trying to buy services of sex workers. We will do that in order to see who they're affiliating with, to talk to them and gain information, and to try to identify and create successful prosecution against their traffickers. That's ultimately, in a nutshell, what our goal is when we call those folks, primarily women who are advertising on the internet. We are not arresting those people. We're not putting them in jail. We're having a conversation and referring them to whatever services that we can refer them to. With the, I mentioned it a little bit earlier, we focus some of our cases on the Johns who are out there seeking underage prostitutes or underage sex workers. So oftentimes myself or my partners will put undercover advertisements on the internet posing as sex providers. And during our communications with some of the prospective sex buyers, we will make it obviously clear that we're portraying ourselves as early teenage sex provider in an effort to try to make preemptively identify those people who are actively hunting for kids in our community with the expectation of buying sex from them. And so we're doing some of those types of cases as well, and they've been pretty successful. Sorry, I mean, it could go on and on. As Tamara said, I mean, it looks like I'm probably getting close to out of time to kind of go over too many of the cases. But as Tamara mentioned, it is a problem everywhere. Our community is not exempt from that problem. So we do have sex trafficking occurring in our community on an everyday basis. I encourage you to seek out information on the topic, just so your own level of awareness is increased, and if you see something out in society that you might recognize it for what it is, and you can report it to whomever you're comfortable reporting it to. And if you have questions, I'll be here for a question and answer session. That's it.
A big thank you to our speakers, Detective Curtis and is it Tamara? Tamara, thank you. And now we will take a short break of 5 minutes before our question and answer period. Thank you.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Okay, welcome back to the June 28th, 2019 program, Combating Commercial Sexual Exploitation. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our gold sponsors, Oregon Country Fair, Network Charter Schools, Jerry DeLitham, Architect, Landscape Architect, and a special thanks to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9, Dot Dotson's Photography, Pack Info, and Simplified Computing, LLC. And now we will begin our Q&A. I ask that you limit your questions to 1 minute so that everyone has an opportunity to ask a question. Thank you. First question.
This is for Detective Newell. If the elements of the offense are the same for the state and federal crimes, force, coercion, who makes the decision as to whether to bring it as a federal crime or a state crime, and what are the differences in sentencing from state between state and federal?
That's a really good question. Ultimately, like I said, there are two avenues for prosecution. At the federal level, it's sexual exploitation of a minor. Generally, the decision to, I'm sorry, so that's the federal level. The ones we typically deal with at the state level are compelling prostitution, or promoting prostitution. Compelling prostitution is a Measure 11 criminal offense, which has a mandatory minimum prison sentence, usually around 6 years. At the federal level, depending on how many victims or survivors may be involved in the case, they typically will get about a 10-year per victim sentence on those cases. And to further answer, I think you said who decides which person gets to prosecute them. Typically, that's decided between the prosecutors. And what they will do, you'll have the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecutes at the federal level, and you'll have the assistant district attorney who prosecutes at the state level come together, and they'll evaluate the case, different hurdles they think that they might come across in a trial setting, and as well as whatever potential sentences either of them could maybe attain upon a conviction. And so they'll take all of those factors in together and decide if they want to pursue it federally or if they want to pursue it at the state.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jerry Smith. I'm a retired social worker. And I make referrals for adults all the time. I don't often run into children, and I have a problem with it. I came from a world when there was welfare and care for all people, and it's gone, absolutely gone. And so I found a 11-year-old child in the library from Ohio, probably brought by a sexual predator. And I called child welfare, and they said they didn't do outreach like that. Should I have called the police?
Well, Kurt says it's my turn. So that's a rough one, right? That's rough. What do you do when you come across a child who is obviously in need of some support? Was this child unaccompanied? Did they have an adult with them? They were just all alone at the library, 11 years old. Y'all, let that sink in for a minute. I think that question really accurately grasps the problem that we're up against with the commercial sexual exploitation of children. It's one possibility that that child was purchased by a sex trafficker and left here. Child Protective Services does have an obligation to take into custody those children and provide them with a safe place to be. I'm not quite sure why. I can't speak to why whichever screener or CPS worker you spoke with didn't have what you felt like was an appropriate response. In the interest of serving that child, you know, reaching out to other agencies, maybe even calling back to CPS and finding a different screener who had a different answer for you might be a good approach to that issue. We also have other agencies in town, even just going to the library staff. I believe most of the library staff, if not all, because they are government employees through the City of Eugene, are mandatory reporters. And so they might have other resources for you. Reaching out to Kids First, which is our child advocacy center here in Lane County, would be another place to reach out. Typically, children who are referred, they're referred to Kids First through law enforcement, usually. But they're an amazing resource in our community for child-specific issues. Another place that could potentially be a resource for that child would be just taking them to the hospital. There at the emergency department, all of the staff are mandatory reporters, and so they can connect them. There's also social workers available at the hospital that would be able to hopefully provide that child with some resources. I feel like that answer is inadequate and insufficient, and also really captures what I mean when I say that we have a fractured safety net in our county. Thank you.
John DeLone, City Club. What happens to an illegal, underage illegal alien who's been used as a sex worker when they're finally found out about? What happens to them?
Okay. So Hi, me again. Our agency, well, first of all, the CSEC MDT typically only deals with domestic trafficking. There are a number of resources in our county and state for international survivors of human trafficking. And I can't speak to specifics, but I do know that people who are here who are undocumented do have certain rights as survivors of crime. So once they engage in any sort of legal system, then they'll be referred through those systems in order to have the appropriate actions take in place. But they do there are protective laws in place for people who are survivors of crime. I see a follow-up question happening.
Do you call the police? I mean, ICE? I mean, no.
We would not suggest at my agency calling ICE. So earlier we talked about the role of the advocate privilege, and one of the reasons that we use advocate privilege and don't report those things to different agencies is because of the fear survivors face for things such as deportation, right, in the event that somebody is here undocumented. And so, you know, in that situation, you could refer them to a confidential advocate, like at my agency. You could refer them to law enforcement if they feel comfortable doing that. A lot of people who are undocumented, they do fear deportation, and so they often won't reach out to law enforcement. But there are laws that protect them from those things taking place if they do report a crime against them. Thank you.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. What the victims that you catch, either underage or overage, what incentives do you have to attract them to a different type of life? Like, say, Looking Glass, do they say they've run out of money? do they have, what kind of things can you tell the victim that is an incentive for them to be, he's ready to go?
We'll probably both have a little bit to chime in on this. Another good question. Essentially, it's just going to depend on the victims individually. They're all going to have different ideas of what they would like to see come out of each individual situation. We have a lot of victim survivors that just want to be done with that life, and so that means we can steer them to different resources at the victim advocacy level. We have some victim survivors that would obviously like out of the life, but at the same time like to see their traffickers held accountable, and so they may be willing to assist, you know, law enforcement or prosecutors with pursuing some of those avenues as well. But I don't think there's any kind of consistency as far as when we deal with people on what it's going to be. Every situation is going to be unique, which, you know, can be challenging at times, but the main reason that we have that multidisciplinary team is so if there's something that I can't do to help them from a law enforcement perspective, then maybe SAS has something that could satisfy their needs at that time, or maybe Kids First or Looking Glass or DHS. And so we take them as an individual at that time, and we just collaborate to find the best resource for them.
I would also add that the motivation to exit that kind of life and to seek support always comes from the survivor. We don't make offers or bids for people. We don't say, oh, we'll save you from your life, because there is no saving, right? We just don't have the resources to set somebody up with a new identity and a new home and a loving family and all of those things that everybody wants. So usually what happens is that survivors, they're tired, they're exhausted, they want something different. They don't want to be harmed or abused. A lot of times they're enticed into recruiting others, right? So peer-to-peer recruitment is something that we see. Youth are recruited, and then they're in turn labor trafficked in order to bring more people into that life. And then they start to see that things that they're being tasked with as part of that life is causing more damage and spreading it, and they don't want to participate in that. A lot of people have a breaking point, but usually the motivation comes from just a desire to be done with that life and to seek assistance and help.
Sandra Erickson. Years ago, in my postgraduate years, I worked as a store detective while going to school at night, and I arrested a lot of people, mostly women, because I worked in a large woman's department store, who were shoplifting. And they were run by the same rings of people that were doing the sex trafficking. So my question is, given that I don't think that suddenly went out of style, I think it's out there still, how does the police department catch the person who is doing another crime and then get the person who is basically running that crime? Because in the time when I was doing it, the person went down for the crime and the person who was really in charge got free.
Yeah, and again, that's a difficult process sometimes. As I kind of touched on it a little bit, but every sex trafficking case that we investigate presents itself uniquely. And so it may get reported to a patrol officer as a noise disturbance in a hotel room, and they go and investigate and find out that maybe it's a domestic violence situation where that person's being trafficked. So we might get it that way. We might get it by way of a shoplifting ring. I can't say I've personally encountered that yet, but I don't see it as that far of a reach. But ultimately, as you were kind of touching on, it's difficult to make good cases, criminal cases, against the person who's really responsible in this world. It's the top of the pyramid, which is the trafficker or the pimp. And a lot of that comes down to the willingness of the survivor or the victim in each of those cases to assist law enforcement and assist prosecutors in pursuing those kind of cases through the criminal system, to stand up against their trafficker, so to speak, so we can hold them accountable and put them in prison for doing wrong to probably not just that one sex worker, but probably many sex workers that we may or may not be aware of. But I think, yeah, I mean, that's the difficulty in it, and I don't think there's an easy answer one way or the other, but that rapport building and that rehabilitation process over the period of time, I think, is very important and necessary for a person to get to that position where they're willing to stand up and confront a problem that's, quite frankly, pretty scary for them, I imagine.
I would also add to that survivors of human trafficking, sex trafficking, they're participating in a social world, and the conditioning that they receive in that is, like, it's very strong social conditioning. Yeah, so that's one of the main reasons that people are prevented from, like Kurt mentioned, standing up and witnessing.
I'm Fred Roberts, a City Club member, and I'm asking this question for two of our distinguished guests, Ron Sticca and John Jancy. The first is, to what extent is organized crime, including gangs, involved in trafficking, and is this a growing trend or a decreasing trend? And the second is it still true that grooming involves getting young people hooked on drugs? Thank you.
So I work gang investigations and organized crime, as well as my sex trafficking world, and there is always an overlap, I would think. It doesn't necessarily mean that all gang members are also pimps. I don't think that's accurate. Or all organized crime groups are all pimps or traffickers. What I can tell you is that they are involving themselves in variety of crimes within their reach, and that sex trafficking will often be one of those crimes that members of a gang or members of an organized crime group might dabble in. So I think in that regard, that does exist. And the second part of your question, during the grooming phase of maybe the recruiting process is kind of way I'm looking at it, is drug addiction? Yeah, I definitely think that is a tool that traffickers will use. I don't think it's by any means across the board a standard, but many of the cases that I've particularly worked or been involved in had some sort of a drug component where the traffickers were readily providing drugs to whoever it is that may be providing sex work under them. And also on the flip side of that is the recruiters who are going out and seeking individuals to act as sex workers in that trafficking organization, they also look for people who are already drug dependent because it's just another piece of leverage that they might have to hold over somebody to keep them constantly engaging in sex work and keeping that flow of money coming into whatever the group may be, whether it's an individual pimp or, you know, a gang-run organization. But I definitely think that drugs play a role in that.
Yeah, I'll second that organized crime, yes. And then with regards to the drug dependency, many of the survivors that I have met with report being non-consensually drugged until they develop a dependency. We know that this happens in youth, and we know that this happens in adults, and that creates many complications, but one thing that it does is it creates dependency on the trafficker. It creates a situation where the person is then engaging in an illegal activity to feed that dependency, whether it's going to their trafficker or shoplifting or other activities. And then the third thing that's a little more challenging to address is the stigmatization that people receive when they engage services or seek help. And so if somebody is drug dependent and they're seeking assistance with an ongoing violent situation that they're experiencing, and they go to seek help and they're lacking credibility because they're using methamphetamine or opioids or some other thing, or they get labeled as a drug seeker within the medical system, then that also effectively closes off adequate channels to receive support. So that particular tool that traffickers use to create dependency in survivors, it has many consequences. Thank you.
I'm Catherine Chant, City Club board member. My question is for the detective, and kind of follows up on the last discussion you had about it. Sex trafficking can be a dangerous activity, I think even probably in Eugene. Are you ever in danger when you get in that mix, and are you ever concerned for your life?
I don't know. I think the short answer is there's, in the law enforcement world, just in general, there's an inherent risk, I think, in any situation. I don't personally feel more at risk when I'm doing the sex trafficking cases. I know that folks who are trafficking people are definitely aware that there are consequences involved, and that over the last few years that those consequences are becoming steeper and steeper. I think they know that if they get caught, they're going to go to prison for a really long time. And so I think sometimes a criminal's mentality may be along those lines. If they feel that, hey, I'm caught red-handed, they may go into fight or flight mode, like maybe what you're kind of getting at, and decide that they want to, you know, do harm to avoid going to jail. I don't know. But personally, I don't feel any more at risk doing those kind of cases than some of the other things that I work.
Greetings, Paul Thompson, City Club member for some time. Thank you for coming today. This is for Detective Newell. We sensed that you came prepared with a few case studies in your back pocket that you didn't get a chance to talk about in the first part of the presentation. Could you select one or two of those that you think we'd be most interested in and talk to us?
Sure. I think maybe one that comes to mind, obviously, I think some of you might be aware of it, might have been in the brochure that was going around back in 2009, which I think is a good one to explain, is to show that this stuff was happening, you know, 10 years ago. And that wasn't the beginning of it. It's been happening for a long time. It's just now that we're becoming more aware that it's a major problem in our community. We're able to kind of work these through, find these cases, prosecute these cases. You got members of the media that can portray these cases, you know, in the news, on TV, in the newspapers, magazines, or whatever. So that, you know, informs the community that it's an issue. But in this particular case, back in 09, we had a local group of people, born and raised here for the most part, that were responsible for trafficking, I think it was like 7 or 8 underage kids that also grew up in the community. And that one had a bunch of different aspects to it. There was a lot of recruiting being done in the local high school systems, at high school parties. There were drugs involved with some of the victims of sex trafficking in that case. There was also some interfamilial trafficking going on, which a lot of people may not think of. When I say pimp or trafficker, you might portray what the movies portray, and it's some person with gold chains and a fuzzy jacket and, you know, who knows what. But I'm here to tell you it can be anybody. And in this particular case that we had back then, we had a grandfather who is responsible for pimping out his daughter, who's an adult. And the adult daughter, along with being a sex worker, was also pimping out her 2 daughters. One was a minor and one was an adult. And so there's 3 generations of sex trafficking occurring within the same family umbrella. We don't see that often, but it does happen. That case was the resolution of that. There were a bunch of people involved. The head of the organization ended up being prosecuted at a federal level. We were able to gain cooperation from 2 of the 7 or 8 underage victims, and so he was sentenced to just over 18 years, I think, in the federal prison system. We had a recent one just a couple of years ago where the trafficker was more of the violent type of trafficker. He was abusive and assaultive and threatening. There was a gang connection, although I don't necessarily think that that case was gang related. That was another one that ended up settling in the state system. And besides the sex trafficking crimes, there were drug crimes, there were firearms crimes, and other things that this particular person was convicted of as well. He ended up getting about 20 years in the state prison system for that one. So just a few of those. We've had a bunch of there are online sexual corruption of a child cases where my partner and I will pose as, let's say, a early teenage sex provider on the internet. Whoever it is reaches out, and during conversation, they may start asking about whether or not we're a child or underage, and so that dialogue becomes very clear, and then we'll arrange to meet up with them. And those particular cases where it's an imaginary victim, I guess, or survivor, where it's a police officer pretending to be a kid, those folks I've seen getting between 3 and 5 years in prison, some of them. So it's definitely, in our hope, going to be a deterrent, so those folks aren't out there actively looking for kids to abuse or purchase sex from. And so that's just a couple I can think of.
Thank you. And that concludes today's Q&A. Before we thank our speakers today, there are a few quick announcements I'd like to make. Thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club's programs on Mondays at 6:30 p.m. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County Cable Channel 29 for televising recent City Club programs. Next week, we do not have a program since it's Thursday is 4th of July. We will take a break for the 4th of July holiday and come back the 12th of July. Please join us again on July 12th. More details and information about future programs can be found online at City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. And now let's thank our speakers, Tamara Leroy and Detective Curtis A. Newell. Thank you. And this concludes today's program. Thank you and see you again Friday, July 12th.